From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm David Byrd reporting. Hurricane Patricia crashes into Mexico's Pacific coast. The storm, packing winds as high as 325 kilometers per hour, came ashore in Jalisco State, about 90 kilometers from the major cargo port of Manzanillo. From our West Coast Bureau, Mike O'Sullivan has more.
It's still a Category 5 storm. It is potentially catastrophic. People are hunkered down, taking shelter in structures that are sandbagged. And the danger is that as it moves inland, there will be very heavy rains, possibly 20 to 30 centimeters in 24 hours, and the risk of mudslides as the storm moves up through Mexico and on into Texas and Louisiana.
That's VOA's Mike O'Sullivan from our West Coast Bureau. U.S. officials are praising the heroism of an American soldier who was killed while helping to save as many as 70 hostages from near-certain death at the hands of the Islamic State. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said at a press conference Friday that the actions of Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler might have been instrumental to the success of the mission.
We were reminded that there will be risks to our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that they face in Iraq, as there and across the world. But it also reminds me of why I am so very proud of them.
Pentagon officials say about 60 U.S. and Iraqi Kurdish commandos were involved in Thursday morning's raid on an Islamic State prison compound, which Carter described as an execution center. For more on these stories, visit our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has announced plans for a broad international meeting on Syria during the coming week. Mr. Kerry spoke to reporters in Vienna late Friday after meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. He said they agreed to consult with all parties and aim to reconvene as early as next Friday in what he called a broader meeting aimed at advancing the meaningful political process. However, the Secretary of State also said that Russian attacks against moderate rebels fighting Syrian President Assad only encourages extremists like the Islamic State.
But targeting moderate fighters doesn't hurt Daesh. It makes it easier for Assad to continue brutalizing the Syrian people. It threatens to exacerbate the sectarian tensions that feed extremism, and it encourages more fighters, particularly foreign fighters, to flock to Daesh.
After his talks in Vienna, Secretary Kerry left for Jordan, where he will meet with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in a few hours. As part of an effort to diffuse tensions between Israel and the Palestinians, the talks come two days after Kerry met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Berlin. In the past few weeks, at least 10 Israelis and nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed in spiraling unrest. At the United Nations Friday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the recent unrest is profoundly troubling and utterly unacceptable.
Security measures alone will not end the violence. Only by resorting a political horizon can we hope to overcome today's despair and focus on achieving long-term peace.
Ban was back in New York after an emergency visit to the Middle East this week. He said all sides agreed on the need to reduce tensions and avoid actions that would further fuel the unrest. At least 20 people were killed and 40 injured when a suicide bomber attacked a Shiite Muslim mourning procession in Pakistan on Friday night. The attack came as minority Shiite Muslims marked Ashura, a 10-day ritual, when they commemorate the death of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The blast was the second to hit Ashura festivities in 2 days and came hours after a radical Sunni Muslim group threatened continued sectarian violence during the holiday. At least 27 people have been killed and 96 others wounded after an explosion ripped through a newly built mosque in northeastern Nigeria on Friday. The blast in the city of Yola came just hours after a suicide bombing at a mosque in Maiduguri killed 18 people. I'm David Byrd reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. Canada ended nearly a decade of conservative rule and gave a victory to the Liberal Party led by Justin Trudeau, son of a glamorous former prime minister. The young Trudeau benefited from a backlash against the Conservatives' military intervention in the Middle East and its image as hostile to Muslim immigrants. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visited Moscow to thank Russian President Vladimir Putin for his military intervention in support of the embattled Assad regime. It was Assad's first trip outside his country since the uprising against him began in 2011. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Secretary of State John Kerry after stirring up a new controversy by seeming to blame the Holocaust on an Arab leader of the 1930s and 40s. Violence between Israeli Jews and Arabs continued. And in the United States, Vice President Joe Biden announced, after months of Hamlet-like indecision, that he will not run for the Democratic nomination for president. His decision seemingly cleared the way for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to claim the nomination. She also survived a day-long battering from a congressional committee probing her about the death of four Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, by Islamic extremists in Benghazi, Libya, in 2012. Lots to talk about Canada. We don't normally talk about Canada on this show, Oren, but it was a remarkable upset, and it could have some implications for Canadian foreign policy.
It was considered a surprise. I think Trudeau was expected to win, but not by such a margin. He has a lot of different positions on issues that are important to the United States, especially him being from the Liberal Party and the United States having a Democratic president. They are likely to see eye to eye on climate change. They're both against the Keystone XL pipeline. As you mentioned, the Conservative Canadian Party had also been sending six fighter jets to participate in the coalition against ISIS. Has already notified President Obama that he's going to pull those back. At the same time, he said that he'll increase the train and equip program that they're participating in. He's also likely to open the doors to some degree to immigrants, including from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Hillary, I'm old enough to dimly remember Pierre Trudeau, who was quite a dashing figure, and I think he divorced his first wife, Justin Trudeau's mother, and he was then seen with, you know, Bianca Jagger and all these sort of Hollywood types and starlets and whatnot. His son is also quite dashing and very young, only 43. I think it's entirely likely that we're going to see more American news coverage of Canada than we've seen in quite some time. What do you think?
I think that, you know, the potential, certainly, if he tries to sort of exploit that legacy that his father really did of sort of this
jet-setter, yeah.
Exactly. I actually think that it's not that he opposes Keystone, it's that he's a little bit less committal on Keystone.
So yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's not sort of as problematic in terms of the U.S. not coming to a decision, as
it
were.
Which we haven't, yeah.
But I think there is a lot of potential place for overlap with Obama, in part because of what they both represent, whereas, Justin Trudeau really ran a campaign of sort
hope of change.
Hope and change. positive optimism, trying to work constructively with different people. So you saw that in terms of his own population being more welcoming and sort of returning the Canadian nice image to the international stage, but really, you know, echoing some of Obama and what Obama represented, at least when he came in. And that, you know, definitely is something that I think, you know, there are echoes of, and that can help sort of in their personal rapport. But of course, Obama's leaving soon.
Yeah, so. And we don't know who will come next. Yes. They were calling him the hair, H-A-I-R, apparently, which I thought was quite nice. He has a lovely, lovely head of hair. Oren, you mentioned the immigration issue. I think Trudeau said he would take another 24,000 Syrian immigrants. And there was an incident during the campaign that backfired on Stephen Harper, the longtime leader of the Conservative Party. He tried to make it illegal for women who wear the niqab, this is the full face veil, to take part in citizenship ceremonies.
and this was seen...
While wearing the veil.
Yeah, while wearing... You had to remove the face veil. Apparently, they had to show their faces to women to, you know, during this procedure, but they didn't want to show their faces during the actual ceremony where members of both sexes are present. And this backfired on Harper. It made him seem intolerant of immigrants, yeah.
Right. First of all, it not only backfired, he tried to implement this rule. The court said no, and he appealed, and the court said no again. So he lost twice. And Trudeau used this to make the Conservative Party look, I think they labeled it as the mean party, and said that what Harper was doing didn't portray Canadian values. And it actually got some distance out of that.
Yeah. Well, that's probably about as much as we'll talk about Canada for a while. So let's move on, Hillary, and talk about the visit of Bashar al-Assad to Moscow. Nobody knew about it until it was over. And the pictures came out of the meeting. You know, I've read all sorts of articles suggesting there's tension between Putin and Assad. This is not exactly an alliance made in heaven. I was wondering what your take is on it.
I don't think it really matters. I think that Putin and Assad are very cold calculators. And this meeting wasn't so that they could catch up about, you know, their common regard. It was because... Putin's made a strategic decision that he wants to shore up Assad, that he wants to make sure that he maintains the Russian base that's in Syria, that he is seen as a major player in the Middle East, which, you know, reasserts the Russian role there. And what better way to do that for Assad, his first trip since the Civil War started, to go to Moscow and show that that's where you go to, you know, have an international meeting to make the decisions that are going to shape the region. It's, you know, it's not Washington. And well, it's not a place that, you know, Washington doesn't want Assad to have international receptions. And Putin is, you know, calculating that what matters most is him showing that he can insert himself, and that Assad has become so much more dependent on Putin, because now Assad's future is largely going to be, you know, to the extent that he's able to at least sustain himself for some time in this civil war, now it's going to be largely at least seen as due to the Russian influence. And this is something that Putin's doing to enhance his international stature. And I think that goes well beyond whatever the two men might feel about each other, however warm or not the meeting was.
All right. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Hillary Krieger and Oren Durrell, and we're talking about Bashar Assad's visit to Moscow. Oren, what was it all about?
This trip was about logistics, politics, and optics. They're involved in a war on the ground. The Russians are providing air support for a combined Syrian Hezbollah from Lebanon and Iranian ground forces that are deeply engaged in trying to regain ground, and they've been doing this under the Russian air support. And some of what they need to talk about has to do with how that's going and what can be expected from the Russians, what can be expected from the Syrians and from the other people on the ground there. The other issue is that Putin has been talking to the West about this possibility of a political transition in Syria and what that's going to look like and how it's going to happen. And a lot of analysts are saying that part of the meeting was to gauge and to talk about what they should say about the political transition. Whether Putin actually believes and wants Assad to step down at some point is unclear. But certainly the timing of when it happens, he's made very clear that it's very different from the way that the Americans think it should happen. The Americans believe that Assad is the main catalyst for the terrorism and the fighting that's going on, that if he steps down, things will calm down. And Putin has said that Assad is going to restore calm and security and create stability, and that when the terrorists are gone, then they can have a political transition. So it's a complete dichotomy in approach. And since the Russians are actually conducting airstrikes and as a nuclear power have some clout in the world, right now he's surprised all the Europeans and the American allies sort of taken the initiative in Syria.
Hillary, I suppose it was wishful thinking. I don't know if there was time to show Bashar al-Assad a nice dacha outside Moscow where he and his family might reside at some point. I think Oren makes a very good point that the Russians have shown no, even though they talk about a transition, they've certainly shown no indications that that it would come anytime soon. And there's also the question of whether the Syrian government, such as it is, could survive without Assad and an affiliated family, the Makhloufs. I mean, it's run more like a mafia state than it is like a proper country.
And that's a concern that the Americans have. I mean, they're very worried, as much as they say that they would, they don't want Assad to go, they don't see him as part of the future of Syria. They're very worried that if Assad does leave, it's just chaos, that there isn't a strong power base, within his contingent, but also, elsewhere in terms of rebel groups.
And right, they're very divided. Very
that that this could pose a real risk, certainly in terms of increasing the humanitarian disaster, which is already tremendously horrible, but really in terms of what is it that fills the vacuum, if anything can, that the whole situation could get even worse
yeah.
If you can believe it. So
let's stay in the Middle East, if we may, and skip south to Israel, Oren, and talk about the situation there. As we know, there's been a lot of violence between Israelis and Palestinians over the last few weeks. And just recently, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a very controversial statement. He said that, and this was before the World Zionist Congress, that the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million European Jews, was basically the result of a suggestion made to Hitler by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti, Muslim leader of Jerusalem at the time. And this caused a firestorm of criticism of Netanyahu. And I wonder, why would he say such a thing now?
First of all, what Netanyahu said kind of goes against a lot of the what historians say about the Holocaust and how it happened. But what he said wasn't entirely inaccurate. What he said is that this Haj al-Husseini gave Hitler the idea to kill the Jews rather than deport
them.
Because if they were deported, they would go to their ancestral home in Palestine and try to create a nation there, because there were already Zionists that were settling in Palestine, and there had already been clashes with Zionists, between Zionists and Arabs in Palestine at the time. Where Netanyahu got into trouble was that the final solution that Hitler embarked on was already in the process of being put together. The industrial complex that to kill Jews was already being built when that meeting happened between Hitler and al-Husseini.
Yeah, in 1941.
But the reason that he brings it up is because al-Husseini also was a propagator of this lie, or this story that, a lie in Netanyahu's word, but the story that the Jews want to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which is a very important Muslim site. And it's built on the site of the former first and second Jewish temple in Jerusalem. So there are some radicals among Jews who want this to happen, and who have been talking about it lately, and who have been going to the Temple Mount and praying against the rules of the that have been set up for how this place is supposed to be managed. But this story goes back to the 20s, and al-Husseini, this man who met with Hitler, had fomented riots in Jerusalem against the Jews, where Jews were killed. So Netanyahu is saying, this is an old story. We've been dealing with this libel for a long time. This is nothing new.
Okay. Time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Orrin Durrell and Hillary Krieger. Hillary, this is a very interesting story I had not heard about Haji Amin al-Husseini and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But still, I mean, the notion of trying to pin the Holocaust on the Arabs does seem like a bridge too far, yeah?
I think that the way he constructed what his statement was at the very least incredibly inept. And I think to the extent that what he was saying, which if you look at what he said subsequently, that doesn't seem to be what his intention was that, you know, it wasn't a German idea to exterminate the Jews. It was actually an Arab idea, is obviously not consistent with history. But what is consistent with history is that the Mufti had a very close relationship with Hitler. He was quite happy to see the Jews killed, whatever way it was going to happen. After World War II, he imported actually Nazi propaganda material and disseminated it through the Palestinian areas. So the idea that he was of a similar mindset towards the Jews, I don't think is inaccurate. And I think the point that Netanyahu was trying to make, which, you know, sort of building on what Orrin was saying, is that this round of violence, as has been the case in other rounds of violence, has very much to do with what's happening in Israel, in Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount, where you have the holiest site in Judaism, the ancient temples, which is then on top sitting the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Third holiest site in Islam,
which is therefore very, very contentious in terms of how you allow both religions to share this space. And, you know, this recent round of violence, you've seen it being stoked by people who are saying that Israel and Jews don't see legitimacy to having a space for Muslim worshipers there. And that, in fact, this site is only Muslim. It's only holy to Muslims. You've seen the UN body, the UNESCO, agree to a resolution, you know, confirming the Arab narrative about this place. Right. And what Israelis believe, rightly or wrongly, is that the reason that there hasn't been a peace between Israelis and Palestinians is fundamentally that the Palestinians don't accept Jewish legitimacy in the region. And that if you're going to have a lasting peace, there has to be recognition of both sides' claims. And while the Palestinians certainly can argue that a lot of Israeli Jews do not recognize their claims, what Netanyahu, representing the Israelis, is saying is that this isn't a conflict about settlements. This isn't about even the creation of Israel in 1948. This goes back much further to a history, a pattern where Arabs have consistently denied any Jewish connection to Jerusalem and to this sacred area, the Temple Mount. And so he was using that to illustrate how far and how deep the hatred is. It's not simply a sort of political fracas that has to do with the latest sort of superficial government interactions.
I think one thing, though, that's very troubling, and it's also a pattern with Netanyahu, is that he always reverts to the Holocaust whenever he wants to score political points. It doesn't matter what the issue is, it seems, whether it's the Iran nuclear agreement or it's the current violence between Arabs and Jews. It's always 1938, or in this case, 1941. And for people who see the Holocaust as a unique atrocity in the history of the world, it cheapens that history to constantly be referring to the Holocaust.
I think, first of all, Netanyahu has probably more detractors than supporters within Israel. You've seen a lot of Israelis and Jews internationally criticize him in this instance and in others. I think, though, from Netanyahu really believes he's a politician through and through. He takes a lot of different forms. We saw him be against a two-state solution during the campaign and then immediately come out for it so he could get back in the good graces of Americans. There's not a lot of things you can say, you know, there's a consistency. But I do believe that he sees himself as safeguarding the Jewish people at a time of tremendous peril, when you have not only this ongoing dispute with the Palestinians over sort of very principal aspects of Judaism and Jewish claims to areas in the Holy Land, but when you have Iran developing nuclear capabilities, when you have the growth of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all sorts of terrorist elements and the breakdown of Arab states that have been to some extent holding the tide and working with Israel. And he believes that actually Israel and Jews do face an existential threat.
Yeah.
And so to him, it's a reminder of what he's up against and what he's sort of historically in a position he sees himself as doing is preventing another Holocaust. It might not be the wisest in terms of how it's perceived elsewhere, in terms of what it does to the memory and legacy of the Holocaust, but I do think he actually genuinely sees himself as the bulwark against a repetition of that happening. Yeah.
I would agree. What's happening, the violence is actually happening right now in Jerusalem. I always think that it's interesting that not to downplay it, but that it gets so much attention when, you know, the numbers are something like 50 people have died so far, and just north in Syria you have
250,000
people dead. Yeah. But the violence that's happening there began with protests against these Jewish groups, mm-hmm. again, radical Jewish groups that were going to the Temple Mount and praying, which is against the, quote, status quo. And Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas went to the United Nations and said that that Israel is trying to change the status quo and that this place needs to be protected. And right after that, the violence mushroomed. Mm-hmm. And Netanyahu has been saying that they're not trying to change the status quo, that the government is not trying to change the status quo, even though it's a democracy and some lawmakers would like to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. And his speech was called the 10 Big Lies or something like that. And he was basically trying to knock down the things that Mahmoud Abbas has been saying.
That's I would agree. We're getting close to the end, but Hillary, you sat through the entire Benghazi hearings of Hillary Clinton. And I don't know how many of our listeners around the world actually listened or watched any of this interesting thing. All I can say is, again, I'm dimly old enough to remember my mother watching the McCarthy hearings in the 1950s. And let me say that the Benghazi committee was nothing like that. And I remember the Watergate hearings, and I think it's fair to say that the Benghazi hearings were nothing like that. What was your impression?
Well, I think that, much to the Republicans' surprise and chagrin, Hillary Clinton came across quite well in these hearings. And unlike previous round, where she had not helped herself by not seeming to take the proceedings as seriously, and she had moments that were later used in clips against her, in this case, she seemed very well prepared. It actually showcased her knowledge of the region, the fact that she's been responsible before. She had some really touching moments where she talked about the pain the event caused her and how, you know, her involvement with what had happened that night, and really, I think, diffused what Republicans had been trying to use against her. And the fact that this dragged on for 11 hours, she had a coughing fit towards the end because she'd been talking for so long. She seemed mostly sympathetic. Towards the end, she got a little bit short, and I don't know how much that will be the image that lasts. But I think they did not trip her up. And in fact, when you combine that with Joe Biden's decision not to challenge her and the fact that, you know, last week she had a really command performance at the debate, she sort of neutralized three main threats against her and showed that certainly she's a very formidable challenger.
Oren, what did you think of the hearings?
At their heart, this question about Benghazi is a Republican unhappiness with policy. Mm. And a suspicion that the Obama administration and Hillary was part of it, treated Libya policy, terrorism policy, and security in Benghazi in a special way because of politics, in order to make it look as if terrorism was not a major threat to the United States. Mm. And that created all kinds of decisions before, during, and after the attack to downplay the role of terrorism and downplay the role of security in the attack. This hearing, even though it was 11 hours and they've been spending, you know,
$4.7 million.
Yeah, lots and lots of money and time working on this. They're not going to get at that question.
Yeah. No, I would agree. The only thing that I saw in the Twitterverse was that Hillary said one thing to her family the night of the attack and another thing in public. And this seemed to outrage Republicans. But all I could think to myself is, well, of course you may say one thing privately This was her private email. And you might not say that in public until an investigation is completed. Anyway, that's all the time we have this week. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Jackson Witt. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.